Anne Burr Farlow came from a long line of New Englanders. Moon-faced and slightly plump, Anne was a music graduate fresh out of Bryn Mawr College in 1959 when she moved to Cambridge to work as an office assistant in the geology department at MIT. On occasion, a Harvard graduate student in mathematics named Bob Morris would stop by Anne's department to visit her roommate, but Anne didn't take much notice of him until one day when he asked the roommate to a concert. When the young woman declined the invitation, the serious young student turned straight to Anne and asked if she would be interested. She accepted. Their two-year courtship consisted of frequent ski trips in the winter and long sailing trips in the summer. In June of 1962, Anne and Bob married. When Bob decided to settle permanently into the Bell Labs job, the young couple went house hunting. Bob, who had grown up in farming country north of Hartford in the Connecticut Valley, wanted ample privacy. They settled on a farmhouse in the small town of Millington, New Jersey. The house dated back to 1740. It had few modern amenities and abutted a steep, wooded hillside, a wildlife preserve that served as a woodlot for the family. The house sat on a 9-acre triangle of land on a dead-end road. A 2-acre field lay between the house and the Passaic River. Unless the temperature dipped below 20 degrees, the 9-room house was heated entirely by a wood stove and a fireplace. Meredith, the first child, was born 2 years before Bob and Anne moved into the Millington house. 3 weeks after the family moved in, Robert was born, in November 1965. Ben arrived 2 years later. On the property, farm animals were accumulating: sheep, chickens, and geese. The family had 3 large dogs and at least a dozen cats. Working cats, as Bob called them, roamed freely. When Meredith asked for a horse 1 year, Bob compromised and got her a pig. The entire household later joined Meredith in her hobby of training seeing-eye dogs. A large vegetable garden provided much of the family's fresh produce, and within a few years, nearly half the family food came from the animals and the earth. Every lamb they owned was named Lamb Chop, lest the children lose sight of its fate. Anne would always describe marriage to Bob as complex. He was completely lacking in conventional traits. For stretches at a time, in fact, he was missing in action. He kept odd hours. For years, his pattern was to work half the night and sleep until 11 the next morning. He believed firmly that if he was going to work hard, it should be at something he enjoyed doing. The children occasionally had trouble understanding that their father wasn't going to be like the fathers of their friends, conventional workaday men who would spin through the kitchen at 8 a.m., briefcase in hand, returning promptly at 6 p.m. Bob's erratic schedule was dictated by the nature of his work. But once Bob finished a major project at work, he would spend several weeks at home working on a domestic job that he found equally absorbing. Bob had a natural inclination to integrate his practical skills with his broader cultural knowledge. One of his more ambitious projects was to design and build a sheep pen. Dissatisfied with the conventional designs he found in home construction books, he turned to the February leaf of a famed 15th-century illuminated manuscript, the Très Riche Heir du Duc de Berry, a wintry scene of peasants working on a farm, depicted in exacting miniature in blues and golds and whites. A centerpiece of the picture is a simple yet elegant sheep pen. The sheep pen on this page of the fabled Book of Hours proved the most practical and aesthetically pleasing design. Bob built its precise 20th century replica in rural New Jersey. Bob's good salary at Bell Labs enabled Anne to do what was important to her rather than just work to supplement the family income. For the first few years, that meant raising the children. Then she involved herself in local and state environmental work. Eventually, she became executive director of the Association of New Jersey Environmental Commissions, a statewide umbrella organization for municipal environmental commissions. For his part, Bob became chairman of the local planning board. Sending the children to the best schools possible was all part of the plan, too. Bob and Anne considered the quality of the local public schools inadequate to the task of educating their children, so they sent them all to private schools. Not only was it a financial burden, but for Anne, it meant she would have to drive them to school every day for 14 years. In order to pay the hefty school bills, Bob and Anne remained frugal. The house was furnished with pieces both inherited and discovered. Seldom was a new household appliance purchased. Washing machines and other large appliances were mostly other people's discards that were old but still functioning. Bob kept a stockpile of appliances in various stages of disrepair in the barn, with at least one at the ready should the one on duty fail. Bob and Anne Morris provided their children with an idyllic, if somewhat eccentric, life. Their range of options and their exposure to life in general were far broader than those of the vast majority of the children of their age. And the family was unusually close-knit. They played in orchestras together, sang in choirs together, and took regular trips to Manhattan. And when the family went on vacations together, it wasn't to island resorts, but to Iceland for a month, or to England for canal boating. Bob Morris's work was on the cutting edge of a discipline that was defining the future, yet when friends came to visit from more suburban communities, they felt as if they had stepped into a time warp. And to complete the picture, the computer terminal resided in the basement next to an enormous 18th-century beehive oven. Bob left the task of child-rearing to Anne. She believed that children should be exposed to a full range of experiences and should be able to draw on that broad spectrum when choosing the direction of their adult lives. Ben would eventually pursue a life outdoors, working as a tree surgeon in Millington. Meredith would choose liberal arts and become a researcher at the Library of Congress. And from an early age, Robert seemed destined to follow his father into science. It was an admirable approach, but it also required a disciplined household. Anne instilled in her children a strict work ethic. Each had morning chores to do outside, animals to feed, eggs to collect, wood to gather. For the most part, the three children discharged their chores without complaint. Some of the work was also a great deal of fun. Gathering wood in the winter, for instance, meant cutting a path up the ice-bound river with shovels and skates and carrying the wood back down on sleds. Anne also made it clear that they were wholly responsible for their assigned work around the house. If Robert neglected to feed the sheep in the morning, he would return from school in the afternoon to a chorus of bleats. Through the years, changes were made to the house that reflected the Morris way of life. Bookshelves went up everywhere. In time, the family library included 6,000 volumes, their subject matter ranging from theology to natural history to sailing and navigation. Every book had been read by at least one member of the family. One day, Bob brought home one of the original Enigma cryptographic machines. On one of what had become regular visits to Fort Meade, Bob had simply walked out the front door of the NSA, accompanied by the agency's deputy director, with the machine stuffed into a brown paper bag. Eventually, it became yet another Morris household curio. The children weren't given an allowance. Instead, they were paid for work they did around the house outside of their normal obligations, such as digging drainage ditches and building fences. Anne was always careful not to pay them very much in order to get them to see that they could earn more money by working elsewhere. Other kids always had more money than the Morris children, and later, when others had use of their parents' cars, Bob and Anne told their children that if they wanted to drive, they had better figure out a way to buy their own cars. Robert and Meredith accepted the arrangement perhaps more easily than Ben, who groused mildly at the restriction. Like many children in rural settings, the Morris children grew up without a gang of neighborhood kids to run with, a nearby shopping mall or video arcade. When the children were very small, the family had no television set. But when it turned out that 6-year-old Meredith was a mass culture illiterate, as Anne described it years later, the family bought a tiny black-and-white set specifically to view Sesame Street. An upgrade in size came only because all three children had trouble seeing the screen at the same time. Still, television wasn't so much prohibited as quietly discouraged. The black-and-white set with poor reception competed for space in the living room with the computer terminal, which had migrated upstairs. When Anne voiced complaints about having a computer terminal in the middle of the living room, Bob gently reminded her that he could have put it where some of his colleagues had theirs, in the bedroom. The young Morrises were early and voracious readers. Meredith was already reading at age 4. By the 3rd grade, Robert had read Tolkien's Lord of the Rings trilogy and memorized its many poems. By age 9, he was devouring back issues of Scientific American. And by the time he was in his early teens, his reading list had expanded to include the classics, history, and copious science fiction. Robert's intelligence was especially apparent from an early age. As a preschooler, he built working-scale models of cars out of whatever tools he found lying around. Paper clips, cardboard, and file folders. Before long, following his father's example, he was pulling electronic equipment apart and piecing it back together. Anne saw that Robert sensed that he was different from others his age, but he recognized only that he was different, not why he was different. In fact, he once confided to his mother that he thought he was weird. She occasionally tried to inquire just enough to test whether he understood that his abnormality lay in his intelligence. But even though it was clear to his parents that Robert was more intelligent than his schoolmates, he seemed only confused and occasionally frustrated by the difference between him and his peers. Robert and Ben started out at the country day school in Far Hills. Robert was easily bored, and his performance suffered accordingly. When Robert got to the fifth grade, Bob took matters into his own hands. He went to the headmaster and suggested that Robert skip into the sixth grade. The headmaster refused, citing school policy. Bob's response was to keep Robert home for 4 days. The headmaster relented, put Robert in sixth grade, and his grades improved immediately. Nonetheless, unhappy with the direction of the school's curriculum, Anne and Bob pulled the boys out and enrolled them in the Peck School, 12 miles away in Morristown. Following the Peck School's more traditionally rigorous curriculum, Robert improved his scholastic performance dramatically. Still, he was well beyond his classmates on most subjects. By the time he was in seventh grade, Robert was reading science fiction at a clip of 2 or 3 volumes a day. Bob and Ben were avid science fiction fans, too. But Robert was the one who seldom went anywhere without a science fiction novel tucked under his arm. When Anne went to Parents' Day at the Peck School one day, she saw her son seated in the front row of his math class, his nose buried in a science fiction book. When called upon, Robert simply looked up from his book, recited the correct answer, and returned to his reading. It was clear to Anne that this wasn't cheek on her son's part. It seemed a perfectly suitable arrangement between the teacher and a student who could read his books and still stay a step ahead of the class. High school meant yet another private school. Delbarton was an exclusive boys' school, also in Morristown, run by Benedictine monks. Delbarton was known for its excellent music department, and after Robert's 3rd week there, he came home one day and announced that he planned to learn the violin. Once Robert started, Ben took up the viola. Anne played the bassoon. Meredith started on the French horn, and Bob dabbled, starting out on the oboe, then turning to the cello. Anne and Bob made music a family focal point. Each child was introduced to grand opera at age 10, with a trip to New York. For years, Bob's annual Christmas present to the family was Hansel and Gretel at the Metropolitan. Ben and Meredith liked using the computer well enough. They logged on mostly to play games, but of the 3 children, Robert was the one to fasten onto computers most earnestly. When Bob stepped away from the terminal, it was only a matter of minutes before Robert logged on. In front of the terminal was a cavernous and comfortable old armchair, its back facing the rest of the living room. Whoever sat in the chair was enveloped by it, and the young Robert nearly disappeared. Then there were the electronic friendships computers created. To give the children a sense of what was possible with computers and communications, some of the parents gave their children their own accounts on the computer at Bell Labs. Aside from some fairly strict ground rules about behavior on the network, the kids were allowed and even encouraged to explore the world of computers firsthand. Ken Thompson's son, Corey, was a regular on the network. At times, there were up to 25 kids using the Bell Labs computers and communicating with each other. Many of them, in fact, developed strong electronic friendships before they ever met in person. Roberts was the first generation to grow up with ubiquitous computer networks. Using the computer gave the 14-year-old Robert his first taste of the power of instantaneous communications, and the social equality that computers made possible. Tapping the computational power of a machine 10 miles away presented an irresistible lure. Robert became a regular, making friends online and exchanging homemade computer adventure games. Not only were they cleverly programmed, but the kids' games also required a fairly sophisticated knowledge of data communications. They were similar to early adventure games such as Zork and Adventure. These games were really vast puzzle-solving exercises played at a computer terminal. They were interactive, permitting the player to explore by typing commands at the keyboard. The games revolved around treasure hunts and magic words. One of the teenagers wrote a game called T4C, The Four Corners, complete with underground passageways. The best thing about the game was its interactive multi-user nature. Players ran into each other while playing. Robert then wrote a game called Run Me, an enhanced spin-off of T4C. In T4C, characters could only talk to one another. Run Me players could also hug, kiss, hit, and tickle. With Run Me, Robert established himself as the games master of his group. Not only were the teenagers learning about computers, but they were learning the rules of the computer community. For some of them, the Bell Labs computer was a telephone and television rolled into one, fulfilling their social needs and their need for entertainment. One of Robert's best friends on the network was the unusually bright daughter of a Bell Labs scientist, one of the few girls on the network. Robert set up some features of the Run Me game specifically for her. For example, the altar in the church would shimmer when her character entered. One of her most impressive achievements was her own wardrobe program, which told her what to wear each day. Her automated decision was a function of the articles of clothing in her drawers and closet. Each morning when she called up the program, it would tell her which pants and shirts hadn't been worn recently and would select several possible combinations for her. Though they lived just 8 miles apart, she and Robert carried on an electronic courtship for a year before actually meeting. Only rarely did the children of the network overstep their bounds. One day, Bob arrived at work and stormed into an office where some colleagues were sitting. He announced to the group in his trademark summary manner that all the kids' accounts had to be taken away immediately. Deciding there must be a story behind this sudden decision, the others prodded him into telling them that one of the kids had been operating as a superuser on the computer. "Well, then just take away that kid's account," suggested one in the group. Bob shook his head. After more probing, Bob broke down and said it had been his own kid. "How did he manage to get the root password?" someone asked. "He didn't." "Well, how did he get in there?" It finally surfaced that Bob had absent-mindedly walked away from the terminal at a point where he had access to everything on the Bell Labs computer, leaving Robert the run of the system. Robert had just walked up to the machine and started using it. Robert was clearly interested in more than just playing games on the computer. By the time he entered junior high, his father had introduced him to Unix, and he was already finding holes in it. He was soon writing his own Unix shell, a sophisticated program for carrying out user commands. As soon as the Unix source code was online, Robert started to study it with special zeal. In his mid-teens, Robert was showing his best friend, Doug McIlroy's son Peter, how it was possible to get super-user privileges on one computer, then parlay those privileges into a tour of various computers at the lab. Robert even modified a few files before alerting his father's colleagues at Bell Labs to the security hole he had found. If researchers at Bell Labs were amused or grateful to a teenager for pointing out weaknesses in their own handiwork, they didn't let on. He was told to stop, and that was that. Even as a ninth grader, Robert was more his father's colleague than his disciple. Bob was careful never to sit Robert down and say, "Here, I'm going to give you a lecture." For weeks at a time, father and son could be steeped in an ongoing discussion of a technical problem. A conversation could last for hours or for days, and while they were talking about whatever it was, it could be a discussion of a security flaw in Unix or of building an electronic circuit together, they remained oblivious to the rest of the family. As the one with more knowledge to impart, Bob could occasionally be hard on Robert, and extremely challenging. In overhearing some of these exchanges, Anne could tell from the tone of Bob's questions and Robert's quiet responses that Bob was pushing Robert. But that was Bob's way. He was accustomed to quizzing everyone anyway, asking his questions in short, clipped phrases that might seem abrupt and impatient to an outsider, but were unthreatening, at times even playful, to those who knew him. Mostly, the part of their relationship that involved computers centered on theoretical questions, yet Bob always encouraged Robert to refine his practical programming skills. To outsiders, it seemed that Bob might even be encouraging Robert to break into computers. In 1982, Gina Colotta, a writer for Science magazine working on a story about computer crime for Smithsonian magazine, went to interview Bob Morris about security. He told her about Tiger Teams and smugly predicted that after a few minutes of looking in her wallet, he would know enough about her to guess her computer password. When she asked him if he knew of any young hackers she could interview, he suggested she speak to his son on an anonymous basis and invited her to the house. The 16-year-old Robert struck Colotta as unusually shy, almost intimidated by the reporter. Anne Morris supervised the interview, and while Anne appeared to be protective of Robert, Colotta got the impression that father and son were a duo, egging each other on. Young Robert told her that yes, he had read private computer mail and had broken into computers that were linked together in networks. "I never told myself that there was nothing wrong with what I was doing," he told her, but he said he continued to do it for its challenge and excitement. In an ironic coda, that year Robert placed 11th in a state high school physics competition. His prize was a subscription to Smithsonian, and the first issue he received was the one with Colotta's article in it. The Smithsonian article came out at a time when awareness of computer security was growing gradually. By the 1980s, hundreds and then thousands of personal computers were linked together via networks, and one user, one machine was the new computing philosophy. But then another idea began to form. Why not create a computing system that wasn't found in a single computer, but was spread throughout a network of computers? Could the system itself be so intelligent that when a particular computing task needed to be done, it could be distributed automatically to the geographic point that had the best available resources? A computer revolution that is still only partially realized was underway.